Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota in Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit Toyota on Nicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at LexusofLexington.com. Introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.
Welcome to Setting the Record Straight. This is Charles Coughlin. I'm going to discuss the Spanish in the New World and how they brought Christ to the New World in the Catholic Church. And I'm going to place special focus on the central role played by Queen Isabella of Castile. The age of the conquistadors evolved into the age of explorers, and this in turn evolved into the age of the colonists. In every phase of Spanish settlement in the New World, a key element was played by missionaries. Each of the three ages was the age of the missionaries, as the cross of Christ was implanted in the New World. The great facilitator of this, instituting it by funding the voyage of Cristoforo Colombo, Christopher Columbus, was of course the great Catholic queen, Isabella, of Spain and Portugal. I would like to read to you a public prayer prayed by the Queen of Castile, Isabella, on the eve of war between Castile and Portugal. It was in April of 1475 that she rose to say these words. Thou, Lord, in whose hands is the rule of kingdoms, who hast put me by thy providence into royal estate, I beg humbly to hear now the prayer of thy servant, and show forth the truth, and manifest thy will with thy marvelous works, so that if I am not in the right, I may not sin through ignorance, and if I am in the right, that thou mayest give me wisdom and strength, I may be able to carry on, and to prevail, and bring peace to these realms, which until now have suffered so much evil and destruction. It may be strongly argued that Isabel of Castile was the greatest woman ruler in history, by secular standards or by religious standards. Under the rule of her pathetic half-brother, Henry IV, Castile had descended into a virtual anarchy. In 30 years, Isabel made it united with her husband, Fernando de Aragon, as the Kingdom of Spain, the greatest power in the world. She accomplished this by no harsh and domineering rule, but by bringing justice and peace, integrity and incorruptibility, responsibility and honor with her, wherever she went, sealed by the love she bore her people and the love they bore her, by her marriage to Fernando of Aragon and the love that sealed that marriage and the unity and harmony in action, which she and he consistently maintained, they made reality of what hitherto had been no more than a dream of unity. Together with Isabel, providing the primary impetus, they completed the 770-year war to reconquer Spain from the Muslims by the conquest of Granada. Immediately afterward, Isabel sent Christopher Columbus to open up a new world and to bring the world together. She struck down slavery in the Canary Islands and in America. She demanded and obtained the appointment of a holy and ascetic Franciscan, Jimenez de Cisneros, as primate of Spain, so that he might reform the church in Spain from top to bottom. With her unfailing support, he did exactly that. Consequently, there was never any support in Spain for the revolt against the church that swept almost the rest of Europe during the first half of the 16th century. Spain became the bastion from which Isabel's grandson, Emperor Charles V, saved all that was left of Catholic Christendom. The holiness of Isabel's personal life matched and exceeded the magnitude of her temporal accomplishments. She lived a life of prayer, loving God with all her heart and mind and soul, keeping the commandments, forgiving her enemies, protecting the poor and the oppressed. She honored her father and her mother, though they had left her alone and unprotected among designing predatory men. She was always a dutiful wife and a loving mother. No breath of scandal ever touched her personal life, though she lived at court in Renaissance Europe, where scandal was rampant, expected, assumed, and when even popes had illegitimate children. She was humble, prudent, persevering, despite great personal suffering from the tragedies that later befell her children. Her life and reign transformed history. Before her, Spain, despite the drama of its immensely long reconquest, had exercised only a minor influence on Christendom as a whole. After her, Spain was the leading power in Europe for nearly 150 years. Rock solid in faith, indestructible in strength, the last flowering of the glory of medieval Christendom upon the dawn of the modern age. Without her, this could not have happened. She raised up the banners of the Crusades that had fallen at Anconia when she was 13 years old. That is why, from the Catholic perspective upon history, the focus of attention in the 40 years from 1464 to 1504 must primarily be upon Isabel, the Catholic. She sent Columbus to bring the cross to half the world. For she had the title, within quotation marks, the Catholic. In 1465, the great nobles of Castile had reached a pitch of power from which they were confident they could depose the present king, King Henry IV, who they described as neurotic, a pacifist, and sexually impotent. Their desire to replace him with Isabel's 11-year-old brother, Alfonso. The war was continuing, and one of the leaders, the Marquis of Villena, a master plotter and betrayer, who in a proverb of the time, quote, never speaks ill or does well, in March 1466 offered peace to Henry at the price of the marriage of his half-sister, Isabel, to Pedro Girón, Villena's brother. Now, Girón was 43 years old, master of the once crusading order of Calatrava, by canon law a monk vowed to chastity, whose lechery and multitude of bastards were the talk of Spain. He was a swaggering bully as different from the devout 14-year-old girl as two human beings could be. Asked for a dispensation to permit Girón to marry Isabel, Pope Paul II granted it without hesitation or investigation of the circumstances. When Isabel was told of her fate, she was completely trapped. Her king and her pope had decided against her. No human appeal remained. Girón would arrive to marry her in less than a month. The marriage would rape her virtue, destroy her innocence, and erase her from history. She went straight to God, on her knees, in a prayer for a full day and night, over and over, simple, straightforward, direct as Isabel always was. There were just two ways out, which could be opened only by his hand. She prayed, either let him die or let me die. Either let me die or let him die. Either let him die or let me die, over and over. Now Girón rode northward with his men to take Isabel. He rode into the Sierra Morena, the Dark Mountains. He rode through the most famous defile in Spanish history, Gate of Reconquerors, Home of Hero, the pass of the overthrow of the infidel dogs. He rode across the dead flat plain of La Mancha to the Sierra de la Virgen, the mountains of the Blessed Virgin Mary, to stop for the night at the little town Villa Ruba de los Ochos, And there his men noticed that Pedro Girón was swaying in his saddle. They helped him down from his horse. Fever was flaring through his body. His throat burned and filled with alien matter. He called for water, but he could not drink. The next day he grew worse. The next, worse still. Choking, strangling, cursing God, with his last breath because he had not let him live to claim his virgin bride. On the third day, Pedro Girón died. For Jesus Christ is King of Kings, and the earth is the Lord's, and prayers to him are heard, as Isabel the Catholic had always known and would never forget. The rebellion continued sporadically for the next 2 years, until Prince Alfonso suddenly died in July 1468, after a supper of trout. Villena and Carrillo returned to Isabel, expecting to carry on the rebellion in her name while she still took orders from them. But Isabel, now 16, old enough and strong enough to act on her own, even though she had no one to help her or to protect her. She would never demand what was not hers by right. And she said, "So long as King Henry may live, I shall not take over the government, nor call myself queen, but will make every effort to the end that King Henry, while he lives, may govern this realm better than he has done. Henry is my brother, the King of Castile and Leon, and I should not please God if I were to commit so grave an act of disrespect as you propose." The Treaty of Torres de Requesendo in 1468 declared Isabel Henry's successor. At her insistence, the treaty provided that she should not be required to marry without her consent, though Henry had to consent as well. The ink was scarcely dry on the official record of the solemn pledges sworn upon the Bible and crucifix when the grandees were plotting again how to twist and break them to their own advantage. Villena arranged Isabel's marriage to King Alfonso V of Portugal. When she protested this violation of the treaty, she was told she would be locked up in a castle if she did not consent. "God is my refuge," she replied. "I call upon him to keep me free from so great a shame and to guard me from such cruel injury." We had just described the quandary that Isabel was in. She had been forced into an arranged marriage to King Alfonso V of Portugal. She had called upon God to be her refuge. She made confidential contact with an envoy of King Juan II of Aragon to indicate her willingness to marry his son, Ferdinand, who was almost her own age. Juan II was fully a match for Villena, who was trying to force her into the undesired arranged marriage. He could and did provide at last the protection which Isabel had so long needed, which even her parents had not provided. The next year was filled with long-range maneuvers and hairbreadth escapes, culminating in Prince Fernando's journey in 1469, disguised as a mule driver from Aragon through hostile territory to Castile and to Isabel. Archbishop Carrillo married them on October 19th, and the greatest royal partnership in history was launched. The union of Aragon and Castile, along with their subsequent conquest of the Muslim kingdom of Granada, created Spain. The manner in which they ruled it, inspired and guided by Isabel and enriched by the discoveries of Columbus, created the greatest power in the world and the reform of the Catholic Church, which Isabel provided for and insisted upon, accomplished at last within Spain the work that had consistently failed elsewhere since the Avignon Papacy and the Great Western Schism showed how necessary it had become. A princess alone, with none but God to aid her, Isabel had begun the shaping of her destiny, which in 25 years was to make her the lay leader of Christendom. By constant vigilance and the love of her people for her, she preserved herself and her new husband from the bitter hostility of the barons she had outwitted during the 5 years that remained of her half-brother's life and reign. Let us see her at this moment of triumph and beginning, as she is sketched by a contemporary chronicler of these years, a portrait clearly drawn from life. I quote, "The princess had blue-green eyes with long eyelashes, full of sparkle along with great frankness and dignity. High arching eyebrows much enhanced the beauty of her eyes and countenance. Her nose was of a size and shape that made her face more beautiful. Her mouth was small and red, her teeth small and white. Her laughter was quiet and controlled. Rarely was she seen to laugh in the customary manner of youth, but with restraint and moderation. In this and in all things, the character and honor of womanly virtue shone in her face. She was regarded with great respect, that no great prince who dealt with her had the audacity to be in the least discourteous to her. From her childhood, she was brought up by her mother in honesty and virginal purity, so that never did her worst enemy find any reason or suggestion to stain her reputation. Her face colored readily under its white skin and was of royal mien. Her hair was very long and golden red, and she would often run her hands to arrange it so as to better display the configuration of her face. Her throat was high, full, and rounded, as women prefer it to be. Her hands were exquisitely graceful. All her body and her person were as lovely as a woman's could be. She was moderately tall. In person and in countenance, no one in her time touched her perfection, refinement, and purity. Her aspect as she moved and the beauty of her face were luminous." Unquote. Isabel, at 23 years old, ascended to the throne of Castile upon the death of her half-brother, Henry IV. She had strong support among the common people and arranged quick, though impressive, coronation the day following Henry's death. Fernando came immediately to her side, and within a few weeks they had begun to practice their uniquely fused co-regency, by which every official action was taken in both their names, and every official document bore both their names. But Isabel's right to the Castilian throne was almost immediately challenged by King Alfonso V of Portugal in the name of Juana, the daughter and namesake of Henry's estranged queen. Adding to Isabel's trouble, a substantial part of the predatory, lawless Castilian nobility, 70 years of weak or puppet government had made many of them little more than robber barons, supported this foreign challenge. It was in this difficult and dangerous situation that Isabel offered again and again before her people the prayer that I quoted earlier, that God would help her if she was in the right, but tell her if she was in the wrong. She went in person to try to persuade Archbishop Carrillo, the primate of Castile, who had married her, and Fernando not to desert her cause. But he committed himself to the challenge and would not speak to her. In 1475, a Portuguese army, very well equipped, crossed the border, led by King Alfonso in person. Isabel had been crowned less than 5 months before, and she had no army at all. She and Fernando were still in the process of raising one. She fired off condemnations of the rebel Castilian nobles by letter to the principal cities of her kingdom. She rode to Toledo to gather troops, and then to Avila across the arid, rocky high plains of Castile. She was pregnant with her second child, and on the way to Avila she suffered a miscarriage. The baby had been a son. Despite this heavy personal blow, Isabel soon brought thousands to join the army. They assembled under the command of Fernando to attack the invaders of the city of Toro, which they had seized near the Portuguese border. But before the slow-moving and untrained troops could be brought to Toro, the invaders had taken two more cities. Fernando hesitated. The army ran short of supplies, and soon it returned to its base with nothing accomplished. With firmly controlled passion, Isabel told its commanders, "One must first give battle to be able to proclaim victory. He who begins nothing finishes nothing. Where will we go and what will we attempt that is good, with so many people and so many resources, we bring forth so cold a triumph. Those who do not recognize opportunity when it comes find misfortune when they do not look for it. Inspired by her confidence and zeal, the commanders challenged and halted an attempted Portuguese advance across the high plains of Castile, whose citadel was held by rebels. The turning point was the magnificent all-day fight of Isabel's champion, the Count of Benavente, with 150 men against odds of 40-1 in the little town of Balatanas. After that, the invaders turned back, awaiting reinforcements. The rebel army was decisively defeated by Fernando at the Battle of Toro, effectively ending the war. Queen Isabel had rallied from defeat as her people had rallied to her. Queen Isabella established a police force called the Holy Brotherhood. It was financed by the local nobles and addressed principally violent crime. It was strikingly and almost immediately successful. She set to work immediately, restoring order in her long ravaged realm. But within a few months, in 1476, there was another revolt in Segovia, where Isabel's best friend, Beatrice, and her husband, Andreas de Cabrera, had been staying with Princess Isabel, the queen's only child. The Cabreras were unable to stop it. The rebels confined the six-year-old princess and her attendants to one tower in the castle. Isabel got the news in Tordesillas, 65 miles away. The historian Palencia, who was present, tells us that not a muscle moved in her face when she received the appalling report. But she sprang instantly into action. Within an hour, she was on her horse and riding southward with only two companions. Cardinal Mendoza, her chief supporter among the clergy, at her side rode the hero of the recent battle of Balatanas, the Count of Benavente. Across the high plains they galloped, unprotected, unescorted, their straining horses casting ever-longing shadows in the reddening light. The 25-year-old queen, like some legendary Valkyrie, drove her horse onward. Next to her rode the peerless warrior count, who had fought for the queen, winning an entire day against odds of 40-1, and striving to heap up the dark, almost swarthy cardinal, no longer a young man. They alone could tame Segovia and save the princess. They needed no one else. They stopped briefly, then pressed on all through the night. As the morning advanced, they caught their first glimpse of the castle of Segovia, gleaming in the splendor atop its gigantic rock, far across the rolling foothills of the Guadamara Mountains. At noon, they reined in at the gates of the city. A delegation of rebels met her, preparing to negotiate. Isabel sat tall in her saddle, and her clear voice rang out. Her words were taken down. The brave young queen stood surrounded by the hostile mob. What she had to say to them, I will read to you. Tell those cavaliers and citizens of Segovia, she said, that I am Queen of Castile. And this city is mine, for the king my father left it to me, and to enter what is mine no laws or conditions may be laid down for me. I shall enter the city by whatever gate I choose. I shall enter it with the Count of Benavente and all others whom I need for my service. Say to them also that they should all come to me and obey my orders like loyal subjects, and stop making tumults and scandals in my city, lest they suffer harm in their persons and their property. Historians record that the rebels fell silent, abashed. Isabel and the Count and the Cardinal rode through the nearest gate. They had to traverse the whole length of the city to reach the castle. Throngs of belligerent people fell back respectfully to make way as they appeared. No one dared shut the lone gate of the castle in the queen's face, though the place is almost overwhelming in its impregnability, even today. A single small bridge crossing a moat so deep it might better be called a gorge. They crossed the small bridge through the one door opening in a towering turret-crowned wall of stone. Inside, Isabel assured herself of her daughter's safety, then returned to the gate, where an enormous crowd was shouting its hostility and demands. The cardinal and the count urged Isabel to bar the gate, but she knew better. These were her people whom she loved and who loved her. They would not fight her. The evildoers among them could not stand against her face to face. With a serene and magnificent confidence, she ordered the lone gate open and the entire crowd invited in. She promised them an investigation of their complaints and justice. They cheered her. The rebel leader fled for his life. After her investigation revealed that Cabrera had done nothing wrong, she reinstated him and the people accepted it. It was the most striking single demonstration in her reign of how Queen Isabella ruled. The year after that, Isabella went south to Sevilla, which had been without effective royal government during almost all living memory, full of factions, strife, and corruption. Everything and everyone had a price. Isabel set up her judgment seat, draped with a cloth of gold, in the once Moorish palace with its slim red pillars, half-dome arches. Each litigant was brought to face her personally. Often she delivered summary judgment on the spot. More difficult cases were referred to one of her counselors or jurists, with orders to investigate further and report back to her. Bribes, however disguised, were scornfully rejected. Isabel spared no one whom she considered guilty. No less than 4,000 malefactors fled the city rather than face her. The Marquis of Cadiz, one of the principal noblemen of the region, who, like so many others, had scorned the law, came in person to beg her forgiveness and offer his services, which she graciously accepted, and were to prove of great value to Spain during the forthcoming reconquest of Granada. When Fernando arrived in mid-September, the essential work was done. It was then that they conceived their only living son, Juan, born in June 1478. After this achievement, they were in a festive mood. Isabel and Fernanda boarded a galley for a 50-mile trip down the river from Sevilla to Sanlúcar de Barrameda at the mouth. Before the galley stopped at Sanlúcar, Isabel suggested they sail out into the open ocean. The Atlantic rolled far to the horizon at the mouth of the river. For the first time, Isabel's attention had been drawn to the vast Western Ocean, which guarded one of the supreme mysteries of the ages, on which the best remembered of all her subject was to find his destiny and change the world. The Portuguese had ventured hundreds of miles out upon it, but no one since the Norsemen 500 years before, and far to the north, had ever crossed it. Just 5 days before this trip, down the river in view of the great ocean that led to the Canary Islands and beyond, Isabel and Fernando issued this uncompromising condemnation of oppression and enslavement of these natives. We have heard that some persons have brought natives of the Canary Islands, and by the will of the Lord of those islands and other persons, have sold them and divided them out among themselves as slaves. Some are Christians, and others are on the way to converting to our holy Catholic faith. And it would be a great burden on our consciences to consent to it. The language and emphasis strongly suggest Isabel's personal authorship of this decree. Isabel climaxed her restoration of law and order and good government in Castile by summoning its parliament to meet at Toledo during the first 5 months of 1480. The most critical problem then facing the realm was a shortage of public funds, resulting from the alienation of the great part of the royal lands during the chaotic reign of Isabel's predecessor, Henry IV. Isabel required all the noblemen of Castile who had obtained lands from the crown to provide a written statement of what they had done to earn them. The findings of the commission showed that most of the noblemen ought to give back at least a quarter or a third of their lands. Isabel called on them to do so. Astonishingly, not one refused. Few monarchs, however powerful of any time and country, could have brought about so massive a land reform without vocal and violent opposition. or at least a major threat of civil war. But in just 5 years of reigning, Isabel's prestige and moral authority had risen so high that nothing of the kind occurred. Almost everyone involved actually seemed to take pride in at long last behaving like statesmen. Isabel insisted that 2/3 of the first year's new income be used to compensate those who had suffered with particular severity from the war with Portugal and internal disorder, notably the widows and orphans of those who had died in defense of the kingdom or in the plunder and mayhem that had scourged the land until Isabel's holy brotherhood put it down. In a wholly unexpected assault on the city of Otranto at the southern tip of Italy in August, Muslims stormed the city and captured 22,000 people. 12,000 were killed, many after refusing offers to spare their lives by converting to Islam. The rest were sold into slavery. The Turks killed every cleric in the city and sawed the Archbishop of Otranto in two. Isabel reacted at once, sending a Castilian fleet to Italy at the moment she heard the news. A year later, after siege and the death of their sultan, the Turkish garrison remaining in Otranto surrendered. But the whole episode was a flare-lit warning that the Turks could now descend on any city on the shores of the Mediterranean. 6 weeks after the Turks had stormed Otranto, Queen Isabel established an Inquisition in Castile, as the Pope had authorized her to do 2 years before, whenever she thought it necessary. Spain and the entire Iberian Peninsula had been for centuries under a cruel despotism of Muslim rule, in which they were considered second-class citizens, dhimmis, living in dhimmitude, with very few civil rights, and only a supposed religious freedom, for the Muslims insisted upon appointing their clerics. After the Muslims had been finally expelled from part of the Iberian Peninsula, the Spanish Inquisition was established to deal with a special problem created in Spain by the very large number of its citizens known as conversos. These were people who had converted from Islam or Judaism to Christianity, either recently in person or as a result of the conversion of their forebears within 3 or 4 generations. Many of these conversions were genuine, or had become so with the passage of time. But many others had been stimulated by ambition and greed. There is convincing, indeed overwhelming evidence, which even the most critical modern historians have acknowledged, that tens of thousands of false conversos continued to live secretly by the teachings and rites of their forebears. Many had risen high in Christian society, even in the church. Some were priests who mocked the Mass as they sang themselves.
Every false convert in Spain was a potential traitor,
and very possibly inclined to opening the gates of its coastal cities to the Turkish mass killers of Otranto. And by the same token, every true converso was open to suspicion of infidelity and treason, their reputation and careers forever in jeopardy of a false accusation to this effect. The greatest danger was in the south, particularly in Sevilla, the most populous city in Spain, not reconquered until 1250, when at least half the population had been non-Christians. Particularly after the horror of Otranto, this danger simply could not be ignored. The Inquisition is the centerpiece of the, quote, black legend of Spanish history. The torture it occasionally inflicted, though not as a regular practice, and the burning at the stake the government ordered for those the Inquisitions had convicted twice, cannot be defended, though they were by no means evil unique to the Inquisition or to Spain. But the historian has a duty to put the Inquisition in perspective. Rarely, though, this may be done. It did not engage in mass murder. In the Inquisition, which will be the subject of another program, less than 2% of those convicted received this penalty. The more usual penalty was on the order of a novena, the more average penalty. Over all the years of the Inquisition, some 15,000 were found guilty of false profession of Christianity, but were reconciled in the church in the public ceremony known as the Auto de Fe, meaning act of faith, a public confession of their error and reconciliation with the faith they had rejected. Very few were irreconcilable. A large majority of all those questioned by the Inquisition were completely cleared, including St. Ignatius of Loyola, St. Teresa of Avila, and all so-called witches whose cases were brought before the Inquisition in the next century. For them, the Inquisition was a shield against being lied about.
Now let's talk a bit about a man named Christopher Columbus. Cristoforo Colombo, right? From Genoese, Italian. He's a man who was convinced that God had designated him to be the man to finally cross the Western Ocean, the boundless ocean.
But Columbus could not convince the Portuguese experts he consulted to review his project for the simple reason, and sound reason, that his data and arguments were deeply flawed in both fact and logic.
So when Christopher Columbus approached the court of John II of Portugal, his proposal to cross the sea was rejected.
The Portuguese geographers and navigators, the best in the world, knew Columbus's estimate could not be accurate. Sometime during 1485, they dismissed him. But Columbus's belief in his enterprise remained unshaking. He went immediately to Spain to present it to Isabel and Fernando. In 1486, at the request of the monk Antonio Machena, head of the Franciscan monastery on the south coast of Spain, and a noted astronomer and cosmologist, Isabel and Fernando did receive Columbus in audience. Now, Columbus and Isabel were exactly of the same age and very similar in appearance and character, though he lacked her calmness and unfailingly good judgment in dealing with people. Both had strikingly fair skin and blue eyes. Columbus' hair had originally been close to the red-gold color of Isabel's, but had been bleached almost white by sun and sea. Both were tall, strong in their bodily constitution, brilliant in their minds, highly articulate, of commanding presence, and with striking personal attraction. Far more significant than any of this, both were profound, devoutly believing Catholics. Of this meeting, we have only a vague account, written many years later. Quote, "And so Columbus came to the court of King Fernando and Queen Isabella and told them what he had imagined, to which they did not give much credit. And he talked with them and told them that what he said was true and showed them his world map, arousing in them a desire to know these lands of which he spoke. Although they did not credit him, subsequent history makes it clear that a spark was struck between Queen Isabella and Columbus on that cold January day, kindling a fire in which the queen never allowed to go out. She knew virtually nothing of navigation and seamanship. She could not herself judge Columbus's claims. In the midst of the final struggle to attain the age-old goal of reconquering all Spain from the infidel, she had little time and no money to spend on an enterprise to open up a new route to Asia. What impressed her was the man, for she was a superlative judge of men. This was a man like none she had met before, a man with a vision and mission, overmastering, overwhelming, with an absolute confidence that he could triumph over all odds, if only given the opportunity to begin. Isabel knew and well understood that sense of mission and confidence. All her life, she had had it herself. She believed in him and never forgot him. In the end, she gave him what he asked, and he discovered a new world for her and for Christendom. Isabel and Fernando began the climactic siege of Granada in April 1491 with 80,000 men. It took all the rest of the year. They never wavered in its prosecution. Though their camp burned, the Moors fought desperately. In November, Boabdil, king of Granada, agreed to surrender the city in January. On the 2nd of that month, the cross, the royal standard, and the pennant of St. James, Santiago, the patron of Christian Spain, rose over the Alhambra, commanding the city the infidel had held for 770 years. The bodies of Isabel and Fernando still lie, as they had directed, in the royal chapel in Granada, with those standards in the adjoining room. Isabel had already promised Columbus that the moment Granada had been reconquered, she would make a decision about sponsoring his project. She summoned him to Granada and sent him traveling expenses to come there from the La Rábida Monastery where he had continued to live. Probably around Christmas in 1491 he arrived, weary and travel-stained, at the now stone-built Spanish besieging camp that they had named Santa Fe, Holy Faith. The reconquest of Spain had been accomplished, and the opening up of America and the Orient to Catholicism was about to begin. Because Ferdinand and Isabella had united Spain, both religiously as well as politically, it did not suffer the religious wars which came when Protestantism began in other countries. Furthermore, a few years later, other parts of Europe went through a witchcraft hysteria, when many people were executed as witches on only the flimsiest of evidence or no evidence at all. 30,000 in England, 100,000 in Germany. In Spain, the Inquisition investigated charges of witchcraft and found them baseless, thus saving many innocent people from death. All the efforts of Ferdinand Isabel, ending civil war, restoring order and justice, completing the reconquest of the Iberian Peninsula, reforming the church, brought peace and prosperity in Spain. The latter years of their reign and many years immediately following are known as Spain's Golden Age, when art, literature, culture, and science reached a high point. During the 16th century, Spain was the intellectual capital of the world, with scholars coming from all over Europe to study there. Out of Spain's optimism, joy, and excitement came the explorations and discoveries which were to open up our own hemisphere and bring about the settlement of the whole New World. The voyages of Christopher Columbus are only one of Queen Isabel's many achievements. Columbus had a totally new idea for reaching the Indies, sailing west instead of east. His mathematics were wrong, for he believed the earth to be much smaller than it really is. But nothing was wrong with his courage or his vision. He, unlike anyone else at the time, was willing to sail into totally unknown waters in search of a new way to the east. He had a deep faith and a passionate conviction that he was the man chosen by God to reach Asia by a new route and to bring the Christian faith to the people there. His evangelical mission was primary with Columbus. It was this deep faith which convinced Isabel to support his venture. Isabel was not much impressed by numbers. She was impressed by Columbus's courage and his character, and she sent him off across the ocean in the name of Castile. On his ships flew a white flag bearing a green cross, on either side of which was a crown. Under one crown was the letter F for Ferdinand, under the other the letter I for Isabel. The voyage west was rather easy, as Columbus' three ships caught the trade winds and made good time. But after reaching what he thought were the Indies, Columbus' troubles began. His largest ship, the Santa Maria, ran aground on Christmas Eve when the officer on watch went to sleep. The ship had to be abandoned, and some of the crew stayed behind in a hastily constructed fort. The captain of the Pinta, who disliked Columbus and frequently caused trouble, even disappearing with the ship for a time. The voyage home was incredibly difficult. Columbus sailed the Niña, a very small ship, through the zone of the westerlies during the worst winter Europe had experienced in many years. It was a virtual hurricane. His ship was battered and broken, and for days on end he couldn't see the sun or the stars for navigation. At one point, he even put a written account of his discoveries into a bottle and dropped it overboard, hoping that it would be found if his ship were wrecked. But at last he landed safely and sent a message of triumph to Isabel. Columbus's voyage opened the door to the conquest and colonization of the New World. Thus did the glories of the High Middle Ages continue to glow in Spain, even after they had diminished in the rest of Europe. This accomplishment is the work of the great Queen Isabel, who richly deserves the title bestowed on her by the Pope. La Reina Católica, the Catholic Queen.
And that's just a little bit of the story of the amazing Isabella. I hope you've enjoyed this podcast. This is Chuck Coughlin. God bless you all. Setting the record straight on breadboxmedia.com.
Redbox Media programming is brought to you by...
We want to help others, especially in places of strife, such as the Holy Land, where Christianity is dwindling by the day. But how to help? Here's an easy way. Buying products through the Holy Land gift shop. Every product you purchase at myfranciscan.org/shop helps Christians support their families and stay in the Holy Land. Olive wood, embroidery, spices, and many more authentic products from the Holy Land are available right now at myfranciscan.org/shop. The Holy Land Gift Shop, bringing the Holy Land home.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media. Find more about us at breadboxmedia.com.